I looked at the two identical bottles of rug detergent on the back porch. One was new and returnable. One was 6 months old and half empty. But which was which? I couldn't tell. They were opaque. I knew that word because I was in the gifted program, but it didn't help me in that split second. Why didn't I pick them both up to see which one was heavier? Why didn't I just bring both of them? I would never be placed in the common sense program. My dad honked the horn for me to hurry up. I grabbed a bottle and dashed for the car. We rode in tense silence to the pathmark. And by the way, I get it now. I'm a working parent, and I understand that sometimes you want to have a very productive Saturday to feel that you are in control of your life, which of course you are not. Children and Jimmy Carter ruin all your best laid plans. And then your wife casts some sort of evil spell? Inexcusable. I followed my dad as he stormed into the pathmark to explain to them what kind of a country America was supposed to be. He took the bottle from me and put it on the customer service counter, and his face went red at the weight of it. I had grabbed the half-empty one. And here was the indignity of the 1979 economy. We couldn't afford to waste the $3. Sure, once the internet boom came in the 90s, we'd all be throwing out half-full mouthwash because we wanted to try the new cinnamon flavor. We'd buy chamomile tea at Starbucks and not finish it, but not Don Fay. Not in 1979. He was going to have to drive home again and get that other bottle to return it. "Wait here," he said in a strangled voice. He left me at the end of the no-frills aisle. I stood there, fighting back tears, pretty sure that it was illegal to leave your 9-year-old at Pathmark. Unfortunately, I was wearing a red polo shirt and shorts. With my short haircut and doughy frame, no fewer than 3 old ladies mistook me for a stock boy. "Young man, where are the plums?" I only hope that one day I can frighten my daughter this much. Right now, she is not scared of my husband or me at all, and I think it's a problem. I was a freshman home from college the first time my dad said, "You're going out at 10 p.m.? I don't think so." And I just laughed and said, "It's fine." I feel like my daughter will be doing that to me by age 6. How can I give her what Don Fay gave me? The gift of anxiety. The fear of getting in trouble. The knowledge that while you are loved, you are not above the law. The worldwide parental anxiety system is failing if this many of us have made sex tapes. When I was a kid, there was a TV interstitial during Saturday morning cartoons with a song that had these words. I can't sing it because it's too expensive. But the words were this. "The most important person in the whole wide world is you, and you hardly even know you. You're the most important person." Is that not the absolute worst thing you can instill in a child? They're the most important person in the world? That's what they already think. You need to teach them the opposite. They need to be a little afraid of what will happen if they lose the top of their Grizzly Adams thermos. Don Fay is from the silent generation. They are different from their children. They cannot be marketed to. They don't feel loyalty to Barnes & Noble over Borders. If you told Don Fay that you never go to Burger King, only McDonald's, because you grew up with the Hamburglar, he would look at you like you were a moron. When my face was slashed, my dad held me on his lap in the car to the hospital, applying direct pressure with the swift calm of a veteran and an ex-fireman. I looked up and asked him, "Am I going to die?" "Don't speak," he said. So, yeah, he's not the kind of guy who wants to watch people eat bugs on Survivor. It's so clear to me how those two things are related. My dad has visited me at work over the years, and I've noticed that powerful men react to him in a weird way. They stand down. The first time Lorne Michaels met my dad, he said afterwards, "Your father is impressive." They meet Don Fay, and it rearranges something in their brain about me. Alec Baldwin took a long look at him and gave him a firm handshake. "This is your dad, huh?" What are they realizing, I wonder? That they'd better never mess with me or Don Fay will yell at them? That I have high expectations for the men in my life because I have a strong father figure? Only Colin Quinn was direct about it. "Huh, your father doesn't fucking play games. You never come home with a shamrock tattoo in that house." That's Don Fay. Climbing Old Rag Mountain, which doesn't mean anything dirty, Michelle. I'm appalled. Let me start off by saying that at the University of Virginia in 1990, I was Mexican. I looked Mexican, that is, next to my 15,000 blonde and blue-eyed classmates, most of whom owned horses or at least resembled them. I had grown up as the whitest girl in a very Greek neighborhood, but in the eyes of my new classmates, I was Frida Kahlo in leggings. For many people, college is a time of sexual experimentation and discovery, and I am no exception. After a series of failed experiments with Caucasian men, I discovered that what I am really into is Caucasian men. And I mean Caucasian. Maybe it's my way of rejecting my Hellenic upbringing, but I like them fair-skinned, with old-timey manners, and some knowledge of fishing. If I'm honest with myself, I can admit that I've known this ever since I saw Larry Wilcox ride a motorcycle on the back of a flatbed camera truck down the Pacific Coast Highway. I like white boys. This worked out perfectly for me in college because what 19-year-old Virginia boy doesn't want a wide-hipped, sarcastic Greek girl with short hair that's permed on top? What's that you say? None of them want that? You are correct. So I spent 4 years attempting to charm the uninterested. It was probably good practice for my future career on a low-rated TV show. I couldn't figure out how to play it. I couldn't compete with the sorority girls with their long blonde ponytails and hoop earrings. I tried to find the white boy looking to rebel, but I wasn't ethnic enough to be an exciting departure. I wasn't Korean or African American or actually Mexican. I was just not all the way white. I realized my predicament early in my first year. We don't say freshman, junior, senior, etc. at UVA because Mr. Jefferson felt that education was a lifelong process. Thomas Jefferson, another gorgeous white boy who would not have been interested in me. This was my problem in a nutshell. To get some play in Charlottesville, you had to be either a Martha Jefferson or a Sally Hemings. During my first year, I had a crush on a brainy, raven-haired boy from my dorm. This played out like the typical sexy co-ed letter to penthouse. He would ask me at least once a day if I had ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket. I would remind him that I had not. He would then describe parts of it to me. After several weeks of mistaking this for flirtation, I tried to kiss him one night by the Monroe Hill dorms, and he literally ran away. Not figuratively, literally. I did go to one fraternity formal with a devastatingly handsome guy named Aubrey Madison Cartwright III from Georgia. I mean, this guy looked like Clark Kent, no joke. He held my chair for me and opened doors. He was genteel and attentive. There was only one problem. Here's how our exchange went when he invited me to the formal. Tina sits on the steps in front of the theater building, chatting with friends from acting class. Aubrey Cartwright approaches. Tina. Hey, Aubrey, you're gay, right? Aubrey. What? No, I was coming over here to ask if you wanted to go to my formal with me. Tina. Oh, sure. I was right, by the way. He was for dudes. So you can see why, when I occasionally had a little success with a heterosexual white male, I dug in and hung on for dear life. And this is why I climbed Old Rag Mountain at night. There was a kid older than me, an architecture student who did plays in the drama department on the side. I won't use his real name because I think he'd find out about it and it would give him too much satisfaction. I'll refer to him instead by how he looked at the time, which was like a handsome Robert Wool. Go spend an hour trying to picture exactly what that could be and turn the book on again when you've got it. Welcome back. Handsome Robert Wool and I were in a few plays and some acting classes together. He seemed to appreciate my sense of humor. Like all boys at the time, he tried to talk like David Letterman, which I appreciated. I don't remember how we first came to be making out in a car, but it was awesome, so I kept doing it. Should it have been a red flag to me that these incidents would only take place under cover of night in the back driveway behind my on-campus housing? Absolutely. Was it not great that there was never any actual date before these events and that it was a secret? Of course. But I finally had my hands on a thin-lipped white boy, so everybody just shut up about it. Secret makeout time went on for a while. Handsome Robert Wool claimed to have some ethical-slash-religious reasons for not going all the way, which was fine by me, as I would have been terrified. I say claimed because I think it was closer to the truth that he was just a control freak who thought he should save himself for someone hot. Sometimes there would be a big drama department event, like a party to celebrate the opening of the robber bridegroom, or a wine and cheese reception to welcome guest artist Aaron Sorkin. Totally true. Handsome Robert Wool would take a pretty date to the party while I attended with friends, and then he'd pick me up later for car sports. Sometimes we would just drive around. We hit a deer once. Why were we just driving around the Blue Ridge Mountains? To this day, I do not understand what this boy was up to. Was it a control experiment to see how much boring nothingness I would put up with before we finally made out? Possibly. We did eventually go on kind of a date. He took me to the mall to help him shop for a present for another girl, and he bought me a sandwich at Hickory Farms. "Can really eat a lot," he laughed when I finished it. I was certain that he would eventually be so impressed with my ability to eat like one of the guys that he would want me to be his girlfriend. So when HRW asked me casually if I'd like to climb Old Rag Mountain with him, I said yes immediately, then raced home to tell my roommates. Clearly, I was very special to him. Why else would he invite me to climb a nearby mountain? They were skeptical. I met HRW the next evening at his off-campus apartment. Yes, the climb was going to be at night. I didn't question this because I didn't know anything about rock climbing, and I assumed that we were in this for the romance. He introduced me to one of his roommates, Jess or Chris or something. He was a wiry little guy who would be joining us on the climb. This was news to both me and Jess Chris. To say he was unfriendly would be the biggest understatement since the captain of the Hindenburg said, "I smell gas." Or, to say he was unfriendly would be the biggest understatement since Warren Buffett said, "I can pay for dinner tonight." Or, to say he was unfriendly would be the biggest understatement since Charlie Sheen said, "I'm going to have fun this weekend." Jess Chris alternated between ignoring me and shooting me disdainful looks that clearly said, "Who is this ugly off-brand non-sorority girl ruining our homoerotic bro times?" We drove out of town a little ways listening to Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes. HRW played that song constantly. He was very deep. Did I mention yet that he always wore a small shell necklace and he told me he was never going to take it off until apartheid ended? It was dusk when we got to the bottom of Old Rag, and when HRW and Jess Chris realized that neither of them had brought flashlights. After a quick debate about whose fault it was, they decided it didn't matter and we should just start climbing. The first leg of our journey was the walk from the parking lot to the beginning of the actual trail. It was about a mile and a half. By the time we got to the foot of the mountain, I was already nauseous from overexertion and trying to hide it. I asked for some water. "Oh, are you kidding me?" The two bros looked blankly at each other. They had also forgotten to bring any water. The next, more difficult portion of the trail was the rock scramble, a feat requiring serious concentration to find a foothold and safely navigate up, over, and in between slippery rocks. It was getting dark now, but there was bright moonlight. It was difficult, but I was actually enjoying the challenge. Jess Chris continued to wish I was dead and or better looking. HRW climbed ahead of us both, showing off. I learned that night that there are markers on these kinds of trails, one color for the easy path, one color for the intermediate path. I also learned that sometimes, especially at night, these markers are hard to see. Soon, HRW told us he was going off the trail, and he'd meet us after a while. Neither Jess Chris nor I was happy about this, but I guess HRW was just too good a climber to be held back. Jess Chris and I climbed along in silence for about 20 minutes. If Jess Chris had trouble finding the next marker, he certainly couldn't get any help from me because I was a hiking novice. I was wearing wrestling shoes, for example. Jess Chris kept calling ahead to HRW to stop showing off and stop being a dick. HRW would call back through the dark that he just wanted to try something and he'd be back on the trail in a few minutes. And then we heard it. A grunt and the sound of little rocks rolling down bigger rocks. And then a sound like a bag of laundry bouncing and scraping down your basement steps. That idiot had fallen off the mountain. Jess Chris and I must have had the same thought. Am I going to have to explain to this kid's mother how he died? We were climbing Old Rag Mountain in the dark on a weeknight? Is this your girlfriend, young man? No. Were you my son's girlfriend? No, ma'am, but he did once tell me that I could be really pretty if I lost weight. What the hell were you kids doing up there? Well, I can't speak for Jess Chris, but I was hoping for a leisurely night climb followed by some over-the-jeans action.
Me too, but then she was there.
We called frantically to HRW. After a few minutes, he answered. We followed his voice back down the trail and found him. Jess Chris climbed out onto the rocks to help HRW over to the trail. He was banged up, but it was somehow decided that we should continue up the mountain. The last half mile or so was not as steep, and we finally made it to the smooth granite top where we sat down to take in the beautiful dark panorama of the Shenandoah Valley. HRW motioned for me to sit near him, and Chris Jess knew instinctively to go sit far away. Tired, dehydrated, and nauseous, I was still ready to make this work if there was any funny business to be had. But HRW didn't touch me. Instead, he stared wistfully out at the night sky and told me about the last time he'd climbed Old Rag. It was 2 days prior, in the daytime. He had brought his friend Gretchen up here for lunch. He really liked her, he confided in me. Liked her so much he didn't quite know what to do about it. After they'd gotten all the way to the top and had the picnic lunch he'd prepared, he offered her a piece of Trident gum, and Gretchen... He had to stop and smile at the adorableness of this. Gretchen had asked him to tear the piece of Trident in half because it was too big for her. Can you believe that? He marveled. A girl so feminine and perfect that half a piece of Trident was the most she could handle. I tried to process what this meant for my evening. So you and I will not be dry humping then? The way down from Old Rag is a forest road. We found a stream in the woods and finally got a drink of water. We scooped it up with our hands, and it was the greatest, most satisfying drink of water I ever had in my life. Oh, the water. Oh, the water. Get it myself from the mountain stream, sang over and over again in my head. I was listening to a lot of Van Morrison at the time because I was also very deep. It was sunrise by the time HRW dropped me off. As weird as the night's events had been, I couldn't help but be excited about the fact that I had climbed a mountain. I never would have thought I could do that. I think someone should design exercise machines that reward people with sex at the end of their workouts, because people will perform superhuman feats for even the faint hope of that. As I crawled into my bottom bunk, I thought about how I had climbed Old Rag. I thought about Gretchen, the girl who could only accommodate half a piece of gum. "I hope you marry her," I imagined saying to HRW. "And I hope she turns out to have a cavernous vagina." Young Men's Christian Association. At 5:10 a.m., the L train from the Morse stop in Chicago to the Davis Street stop in Evanston is surprisingly safe for young white women. The only people on the train at that hour are Polish women on their way home from cleaning office buildings all night. They share plastic containers of pale Slavic food that you know is buttery and delicious. It's just potatoes, rice, meat, and cabbage in an endless series of combinations. My first and only day job so far was at the YMCA in Evanston, Illinois. I had moved to Chicago on Halloween of 1992, pulling into Rogers Park with people whipping eggs at my dad's Pontiac in accordance with the holiday. I had never waited tables, and my attempt to lie about that to the manager of the Skokie, Illinois Ruby Tuesday was unsuccessful. "Where did you work?" "The Carriage House in Havertown, Pennsylvania." My more worldly friend from home had told me to make up a restaurant and give them her phone number. "Did you do hand service or tray service, Trey?" My friend from home had told me to say tray service because it's easier. "What was your favorite thing about waiting tables?" My friend from home had not anticipated this question. The children? Waiting on cute kids. It was a family restaurant. Game over. While the children may be a good nonsense answer for a Miss Universe contestant or a gubernatorial candidate, anyone who has ever waited tables or simply gone to a restaurant with a child knows that children are the soul-sucking worst. They take all the sugar packets out of the bowl, spill milk all over the place, and their wasted meals only cost $5 as compared to a nice booze-drinking adult to whom you might be able to upsell a crispy onion and jalapeno crappetizer. I did not get the waiting job. I applied for a job as the night box office manager of a small theater company in Boys Town. The job paid about $5 an hour for a 4-hour shift, So I was surprised to find that it required a lengthy interview with the artistic director of the theater. I had a degree in drama, I explained. We talked, meaning she talked, about playwrights she liked. It was between me and another girl for the job, and she needed to know what I had to offer the tiny, pretentious theater company, because we like to think of ourselves as the most exciting theater company in Chicago. I tried to joke. I like to think of myself as the most beautiful woman in the world, but where will that get either of us, really? The other girl got the job. My mother arranged for a friend to see me at a downtown lawyer's office for a receptionist job. I wore the electric blue polyester Hillary Clinton power suit that my roommate and I shared for such occasions. The hour-long train ride and scramble to find the exact address had made me late, and by the time I got to the interview, I was sweating my roommate's BO out of the suit. The stench of every drink and every cigarette she'd had the last time she wore it filled the high-end office in which I interviewed. Between the suit, its booze cloud, and my thick virgin eyebrows, I was deemed unfit to answer phones in plain view. I was turning out to be college-educated and unemployable in even the most basic way. Thankfully, my electric blue suitmate was an uninhibited vagina about town. She hooked up with an early Obama prototype named Marcus, who worked at the Evanston YMCA. They were looking for someone to work the front desk from 5:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. I got the job! Evanston is the diverse suburb just north of Chicago where Northwestern University is. The YMCA there was a great mix of high-end, yuppie fitness facility, a wonderful community resource for families, and an old-school residence for disenfranchised men. It may also have been the epicenter of all human grimness. There was a resident named Mr. Engler who wore a wig on top of his hair like a hat. He came downstairs once a week to get his Meals on Wheels, which were left with me. I developed a one-flew-over-the-cuckoo's-nest style of professionalism. I've always been a zealot that way. I'm the jerk who starts to drawl when talking to Southerners, and I get very butch very fast when playing organized sports. Here we go. Hands on knees, ladies. So when it came to the weird residence at the Y, I leaned right into the role of respectful put-upon caregiver. Mr. Engler, your meals are here. He would say nothing and make no eye contact as he slid the containers toward himself with his Howard Hughes fingernails. You have a good day, sir. I would go back to folding towels with stoic dignity like Michael Learned on Nurse. Sir, may I see your room key? I'd bark across the lobby like a young Betty Thomas on Hill Street Blues. The residents weren't allowed to have guests up in their rooms, and every now and then a guy would come in with a friend wearing a big coat and a hat, and you'd realize it was a woman. These borderline homeless guys were sneaking women up into their rooms, which only goes to show that women continue to corner the market on low gag reflex. Not all residents were catatonic. There was Joe, the male guy. Joe had a big white mustache and a friendly Daffy Duck speech impediment from missing teeth. He straddled the worlds of the residents in the office because he had a part-time job sorting the mail. Morning, Joe. I'd smile like Mary Lou Henner in Taxi. What's up, kid? Joe would fire back. We'd goof on our co-workers and laugh it up at the members who gave us a hard time. All that was missing was the studio audience and an $80,000 an episode salary. Donna worked the phones. A heavyset redheaded gal with no makeup and big fleshy hands, Donna was harder to play opposite. Generally, if she was complaining about some work situation, you could pass the time by agreeing with her, but it had to be done in a specific way. All the complaining had to be done with very few words and no dramatic flair. To rant and rave would be too show-offy. Donna would never hold court, and you shouldn't either. Her complaints were like little World War II telegrams of bad news. Donna, they're making us work on Thanksgiving. Me, no way, are you kidding me? Donna, members want to work out. Me, that sucks, weren't you going to go visit your daughter in Indiana? Donna, postponed. But do not try to get ahead of Donna and initiate the complaining, no matter how sure you are that she'll agree, because Donna will leave you hanging every time. Me, can you believe they're cutting our lunch down to half an hour, lowering our pay by 10%, taking away our insurance, and making us eat dirt? Donna, I don't go to doctors. I like dirt anyway, so fine by me. Donna was an enigma, wrapped in bacon, wrapped in a crescent roll. One Monday, Donna came in and said that her husband had had a heart attack over the weekend. And by the way, she didn't open with this. She slipped it in about 20 minutes into her shift. She said her husband started having chest pains on Saturday. On their way to the ER, he'd made her stop at Burger King because he knew once he got to the hospital, they'd never let him have that stuff again. She didn't say anything else about it, but I covered the phones for her a couple times that day while she went to the bathroom, presumably to cry. That's the main thing I learned in that job, how to be a considerate coworker. Cover the phones for someone so they can pee. Punch someone's time card in for them after lunch so they can stop and buy a birthday card. Help people when their register doesn't add up. Don't be a tattletale. I'm the kind of person who likes to feel like part of a community. I will make strange bedfellows rather than have no bedfellows. In high school, I had this friend for a while named Dawn. We were sitting in my house watching MTV one day when a Tina Turner video came on. On the stage behind Tina Turner was a giant set of letters spelling out Tina. Dawn. Well, can you imagine ever seeing your name that big? Me. Yeah. Well, that is my name. Dawn. What? Oh. Yeah. We could rap like that for hours. The point is, I liked the YMCA job at first because I wanted so desperately to like it. My day wasn't wall-to-wall grimness. The members of the gym were perfectly nice yuppies and young moms. There was a gorgeous red-headed baby I called Big Head Bob who brightened my day whenever he came in for toddler gym and stuff and mommy and things. The Y had a preschool attached to it, and the parade of little kids coming over to swim was adorable and life-affirming. I developed a crush on a shoulderless young preschool teacher named Eli. He was a complete nerd, but he had big brown eyes, and he was great with the kids. And remember, when you work in what is basically a cage that you're not allowed to leave, your choices are limited to what strolls by. Which isn't to say I didn't have any other options. I was hit on by a resident once. He was a 40-something white guy who was only there for a week or so. He told us that he was in town scouting locations for a movie. I don't know what kind of movie would put their location scout up at a YMCA, but if I had to guess, I would say it was not Titanic. Anyway, this guy seemed almost normal until he walked up to me one day at the front desk and handed me a little cardboard box and said, "Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?" and walked away. In the box was a packet of sweet tarts and two used Linda Ronstadt tapes. Needless to say, we married in the spring. Eli, the preschool teacher, which is what he'd be called if this were Fiddler on the Roof, was also an aspiring actor, so I invited him to come see a staged reading of a play I was in. He said yes, and then showed up with his girlfriend, who was a doctor. She had about as much personality as he had shoulders. I settled into a daily routine. Wake up at 4:40 a.m., get on the train north by 10 after 5, punch in by 5:30. I learned how long a morning can be. If you're at work at 5:30 a.m., 5 hours go by, and it is 10:30 in the morning. I didn't experience that again until I had a newborn baby. Does make you feel like an asshat for all those years in college when you slept until 12:45. At my lunch break, I'd buy a sandwich from the machine in our venditeria. Apparently, it used to be a real cafeteria with the greatest fries, but then someone decided that wasn't quite sad enough, and it was grimovated into a room full of vending machines. On Fridays, I might treat myself to a greasy slice of pizza and onion rings at Gigio's down the street. I'd try not to think about the fact that my $7 meal was basically an hour's wages. On my way back and forth, I might encounter Gregory. Gregory was a fixture around Evanston, well known for stopping anyone on the street and telling them his story, which went like this. "Hello, my name is Gregory. I used to be an accountant. I had a lovely wife and family. I had a big house. One day I had to go to the store, but my wife had the car. I took my bike, but I didn't wear a helmet. I got hit by a truck. I suffered a head injury. I still have difficulty walking. I lost everything. My wife left me. I lost my job. So when you ride your bike, think of me and always wear a helmet." His injury had also destroyed his short-term memory, so he would tell you this story every time he met you. When Gregory wasn't walking around town telling his story, he was coming to the Y for his daily swim. I met him every day for several months. The people who worked upstairs in the offices would breeze by the front desk to pick up their messages, returning from their hour-long lunches in restaurants, going to the bathroom whenever they wanted. The office people had it made. A guy in boxer shorts never screamed at them that the resident lounge TV was broken. They never got reprimanded for peeling an orange while working. Our only power over them was that we had to buzz them in to the front desk area. And sometimes Donna and I would buzz it too short, so they'd push in the door and it was already locked again. The small joys. The guy in charge of the residence was a big, doughy, bald guy whose last name had more consonants in it than I have in this audiobook. I always thought he had the hardest job. He had to deal with all these gentlemen and whatever their complicated, depressing backstories were. He seemed to have a lot of compassion, but he also had to be tough and kick people out sometimes. Unlike the women who ran the fitness program or the childcare program, he experienced 0.0 fun in his day-to-day work. Even at Christmas, when other departments were doing crafts with kids or having Secret Santa with their coworkers, Mr. McCrish had to organize a holiday dinner in the basement for all the men who had nowhere to go. When I took the job at the front desk in early November, I had stipulated that I had to have a few days off around Christmas because I had already booked a flight home to see my family. This being my first Christmas after college, I was used to having a month off over the holidays, and cutting that down to a 3-day weekend already had me weepy and depressed. I'm sure that I in some way screwed Donna over by doing this, and she probably ranted and raved to her husband, "Gotta work Christmas. Stop." The 23rd came. I punched my time card and headed out, excited to see my family and enjoy some middle-class comforts. On my way out of the building, I passed the men's residence Christmas dinner. If you've ever witnessed a school bus accident or a dog trying to nudge its dead owner back to life, the sight of this dinner probably wouldn't affect you. But for me, it was easily the saddest thing I have ever seen in my life. The residents were at a long table in the basement, and Mr. McTushkos was wearing a Santa hat with his dingy suit. There had been some kind of turkey dinner because the place smelled like gravy, and they were just opening their presents. A tall, goony kid named Timmy held up a pair of tube socks. "There were tube socks for Mr. Engler. Opening tube socks over here, boss." They all got tube socks. It wasn't the tube socks that got me. It wasn't knowing that these guys would get nothing else for Christmas. It was the thought of Mr. Mikushkevich at the dollar store buying 40 pairs of tube socks that set me weeping all the way home. This was compounded by the fact that Whitney Houston's cover of "I Will Always Love You" was constantly on my FM Walkman radio around that time. I think that made me cry because I associated it with absolutely no one. After a visit to civilization with my family, I found the front desk harder to take. There was a rich old guy named John Donnelly who must have donated a bunch of money. He had forgotten his member card one day when I tried to explain that it was a $4 fee to enter without a card. He went batshit. "Don't you know who I am, goddammit?" I had never seen him before. "Do you know who I am?" I wanted to say. "Then how could I know who you are? We don't know each other." My boss pulled me aside and told me to just give him whatever he wanted, no matter how much of a prick he was. I found he usually wanted a free guest pass for whoever was with him instead of paying the $6. This chiseling behavior helped me realize that most gym fees are a scam and only suckers pay them. I found myself pocketing the occasional guest pass money and treating myself to some GGOs. What was happening to my moral compass? One day, sweet, goony Timmy came downstairs to the lobby with a dark look in his eyes. He was pacing the lobby, ignoring us. "He's off with meds!" Joe Daffy ducked from the mailroom when he saw him. "He's off with meds!" Joe's Daffy Duckism spread into his body as he flitted around in a panic. By the time I figured out that Joe was saying he's off his meds, as in he's off his medication, it was too late. Sweet Timmy had rushed up to a young mom in Lycra workout pants and blurted, "I want to squirt it in your mouth." Poor Tim. He was in big trouble. Mr. McCurk had to be called in early. The young mother was beside herself. That's the kind of trouble you get when diverse groups of people actually cross paths with one another. That's why many of the worst things in the world happen in and around Starbucks bathrooms. I started to see a pattern at the Young Men's Christian Association. It was a power pyramid. At the bottom were all these disenfranchised residents who had to be taken care of like children. Above them were a middle class of women who did all the work and kept the place running. And above them were two or three of the least useful men you ever met. There was our comptroller, Lonnie, who never once entered a room without saying, "Are we having fun yet?" He never went anywhere without food on his face. And his exit line was always, "There's a million stories in the Naked City." There was the program director, who talked exclusively in nonsense business language. "We are attempting to proactivate the community by utilizing a series of directives intended to maximate communicative agreeance." At the very top of the pyramid was Executive Director Rick Chang, who had no idea who anyone was or what anyone did. He was the one who reprimanded me for peeling an orange. I heard from Donna that an office job was opening up upstairs. Vicky's assistant's going back to school. Stop. Think I'm going to go for it. Stop. I was happy for Donna. Getting a job in the office would literally change her life. I continued to be strung along by Eli No Shoulders, which is what he'd be called if this were a Native American folktale. He now claimed to have broken up with his girlfriend. I sat through a lot of Hal Hartley movies. He described his plans for a one-man show about Charlie Chaplin. Nothing came of any of it. By the end of January, I had started taking improv classes at night. I was making new friends, actual friends who were not from the planet Grimm. But the classes cost money, and my 4:40 a.m. wake-up was getting harder and harder. One February morning, it was so cold, they closed school. There wasn't any snow. They just closed school because they didn't want kids dropping dead at the bus stop. I waited for the train at 5:10 a.m., wrapped in multiple hats and scarves so that only my eyes were exposed. By the time I got to Evanston, all the blood vessels around my eyes had burst from the temperature. I ran into Gregory. He told me his story. I assured him that I would always wear a bike helmet. When I finally punched in, one of my coworkers at the front desk was giggling about something. He told me that Daffy Duck Joe was telling people that he and I were doing it. That's what I get for engaging in simple pleasantries? A 60-year-old hobo is jerking it to me upstairs? Before I could get too worked up, Gregory was now at the front desk. As I swiped his membership card, he introduced himself to me, told me his story, and suggested I wear a bike helmet. Rising to an Irish boil behind Gregory was John Donnelly, who could not be kept waiting. Take my card. Don't you know who I am? God damn it! Enough was enough. I was going to have to steal that office job from Donna. And that is where my college education finally gave me the unfair advantage I'd been waiting for. I wore jeans to my interview with Vicky. It was easy. Did I have basic computer skills? Sure. I was 22. Did I have a good temperament on the phone? Sure. What were my career goals? Do this job to pay for improv classes. Good enough. I went back downstairs to relieve Donna on the phones. You're up, I told her. As I watched her trundle nervously up the steps to her interview, I knew it was no contest. Poor Donna had been at the front desk too long. You could smell other people's grimness on her, like my roommate's B.O. wafting out of the blue suit. Donna would have thrown herself into that office job with deep commitment for the rest of her life. I stayed on less than a year and bailed when I got a job with the Second City Touring Company. That makes me sound like a jerk, I know. But remember the beginning of the story where I was the underdog? No? Me neither. The Windy City, full of meat. The most fun job I ever had was working at a theater in Chicago called The Second City. If you've never heard of The Second City, it is an improvisation and sketch comedy theater in Chicago, founded in 1959 by some University of Chicago brainiacs. There's a Second City theater in Chicago and one in Toronto, and between the two, they have turned out some mind-blowing alumni, including John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd, Chris Farley, John Candy, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Steve Carell, Amy Sedaris, Amy Poehler, and Stephen Colbert. I could go on, but my editor told me that that was a cheap way to flesh out the audiobook. I moved to Chicago in 1992 to study improv, and it was everything I wanted it to be. It was like a cult. People ate, slept, and definitely drank improv. They worked at crappy day jobs just to hand over their money for improv classes. Eager young people in khakis and polo shirts were willing to do whatever teachers like Del Close and Martin DeMott told them to. In retrospect, it may actually have been a cult. I had studied legit acting methods in college, Stanislavski, Meisner, Cecily Barry's The Actor and His Text, but any TV critic will tell you that I never mastered any of them. Improvisation as a way of working made sense to me. I love the idea of two actors on stage with nothing, no costumes, no sets, no dialogue, who make up something together that is then completely real to everyone in the room. The rules of improvisation appealed to me not only as a way of creating comedy, but as a worldview. Studying improvisation literally changed my life. It set me on a career path towards Saturday Night Live. It changed the way I look at the world, and it's where I met my husband. What has your cult done for you lately? Sidebar. The rules of improvisation that will change your life and reduce belly fat. Improv will not reduce belly fat. The first rule of improvisation is agree. Always agree and say yes. When you're improvising, this means you are required to agree with whatever your partner has created. So if we're improvising and I say, freeze, I have a gun, and you say, That's not a gun. It's your finger. You're pointing your finger at me. Our improvised scene has ground to a halt. But if I say, freeze, I have a gun, and you say, the gun I gave you for Christmas, you bastard. Then we have started a scene because we have agreed that my finger is, in fact, a Christmas gun. Now, obviously, in real life, you're not always going to agree with everything everyone says, but the rule of agreement reminds you to respect what your partner has created and to at least start from an open-minded place. Start with a yes and see where that takes you. As an improviser, I always find it jarring when I meet someone in real life whose first answer is no. No, we can't do that. No, that's not in the budget. No, I will not hold your hand for a dollar. What kind of way is that to live? The second rule of improvisation is not only to say yes, but yes and. You're supposed to agree and then add something of your own. If I start a scene with, I can't believe it's so hot in here, and you just say, yeah, we're kind of at a standstill. But if I say, I can't believe it's so hot in here, and you say, what did you expect? We're in hell. Or if I say, I can't believe it's so hot in here, and you say, yes, this can't be good for the wax figures. Or if I say, I can't believe it's so hot in here, and you say, I told you we shouldn't have crawled into this dog's mouth. Now, we're getting somewhere. To me, yes and means don't be afraid to contribute. It's your responsibility to contribute. Always make sure you're adding something to the discussion. Your initiations are worthwhile. The next rule is make statements. This is a positive way of saying, don't ask questions all the time. If we're in a scene and I say, who are you? Where are we? What are we doing here? What's in that box? I'm putting pressure on you to come up with all the answers. In other words, whatever the problem, be part of the solution. Don't just sit around raising questions and pointing out obstacles. We've all worked with that person. That person is a drag. It's usually the same person around the office who says things like, oh, there's no calories in it if you eat it standing up. And I felt menaced when Terry raised her voice. Make statements also applies to us women. Speak in statements instead of apologetic questions. No one wants to go to a doctor who says, I'm going to be your surgeon. I'm here to talk to you about your procedure. I was the first in my class at Johns Hopkins, so... Make statements with your actions and your voice. Instead of saying, where are we? Make a statement like, here we are in Spain, Dracula. Okay, here we are in Spain, Dracula may seem like a terrible start to a scene, but this leads us to the best rule. There are no mistakes, only opportunities. If I start a scene as what I think is very clearly a cop riding a bicycle, but you think I am a hamster in a hamster wheel, guess what? Now I'm a hamster in a hamster wheel. I'm not going to stop everything to explain that it was really supposed to be a bike. Who knows? Maybe I'll end up being a police hamster who's been put on hamster wheel duty because I'm too much of a loose cannon in the field. In improv, there are no mistakes, only beautiful, happy accidents. And many of the world's greatest discoveries have been by accident. I mean, look at the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup or Botox. When I first started working at the Second City, there were two resident companies and three touring companies. The resident companies would write and perform original sketch comedy shows for packed houses in Chicago. The touring companies would take the best pieces from these shows and perform them in church basements and community centers around the country. We traveled by van to all kinds of destinations from upstate New York to St. Paul, Minnesota to Waco, Texas. In the touring company, we were paid $75 per show and a $25 a day per diem. Of course, sometimes you'd have a show in Kansas, followed by a show in Texas, followed by another show in Kansas, so you'd have to ride in the van for 2 days to get to your $75 gig. It wasn't lucrative, but it was show business. There were three touring companies, Red Company, Green Company, and Blue Company. I was in the Blue Company, or Blue Co., as we called it, to be unbelievably cool. I still feel affection for the members of Blue Co. like we served in the military together, specifically the French military, because we were lazy and a little bit sneaky. For example, they once sent us on a tour of Texas and the Midwest, and the moment the van pulled away from the theater, we all agreed to throw out the best of sketches we'd been directed to perform and replace them with our own original material. Amy Poehler, in particular, was tired of being handed dated old blonde girl roles where all her lines were things like, here's your coffee, honey, or Mr. Johnson will see you now, or what do you mean a blind date? Each night, we'd pull out an old sketch and replace it with something of our own. My friend Ali Farinakian, who is a genius in many ways, wrote a very funny monologue about the McDonald's Big Mac. During the course of the monologue, he would eat an entire Big Mac extra value meal on stage. Because the meal was technically a prop, he made the stage manager buy it for him every night, and he kept his $25. These were the kinds of skills you learned touring for the Second City. By the time we returned to Chicago 10 days later, the Best Of show was completely gone, and we were in big trouble. Except we didn't really care. Bossy Pants lesson number 183. You can't boss people around if they don't really care. The producers tried to punish Blue Co. by giving us the worst gigs. Prom shows were held at 1 a.m. after a high school prom, and attendance was mandatory. It was basically a way to keep kids from drinking or having sex on prom night, and the performers hated doing these shows almost as much as the kids hated watching them. Imagine how mad you would be if you were missing out on a toothy knob job to watch some cult members make up a song about the 1996 election. There were other terrible shows. Brightly lit hotel ballrooms with broken microphones. College shows where the kids were all drunk. Charity buyouts where the audience was very, very sober. Corporate gigs at 8 in the morning for employees who were there to be told about reductions in their health care benefits. Basically, any time you were performing for an audience that was not there voluntarily, it was a rough show. After 7 or 8 months of touring, we started to wonder which of us actors would get promoted to one of the main companies. The main stage cast and the Second City ETC cast got to stay in Chicago and earn a unionized living wage. They would develop their own sketches by improvising in front of an audience, then heaping the ideas that worked until they had a full 2-hour show. It was the dream job. However, of all the places I've worked that were supposedly boys' clubs, the Second City was the only place where I experienced institutionalized gender nonsense. For example, a director of one of the main companies once justified cutting a scene by saying, "The audience doesn't want to see a scene between two women." What? More on that later. In 1995, each cast at the Second City was made up of 4 men and 2 women. When it was suggested that they switch one of the companies to 3 men and 3 women, the producers and directors had the same panicked reaction. "You can't do that. There won't be enough parts to go around. There won't be enough for the girls." This made no sense to me, probably because I speak English and have never had a head injury. We weren't doing Death of a Salesman. We were making up the show ourselves. How could there not be enough parts? Where was the yes and? If everyone had something to contribute, there would be enough. The insulting implication, of course, was that the women wouldn't have any ideas. I'm happy to say that the producers did jump into the 20th century and switch to a cast of 3 and 3, and I got to be that third woman in the first gender-equal cast. However, I must say, as a point of pride, that I didn't get that job because I was a woman. I got the job because Amy Poehler had moved to New York with the Upright Citizens Brigade, and I was the next best thing. But this was the first time I experienced what I like to call the myth of not enough. When I worked at Saturday Night Live, I had a 5 a.m. argument with one of our most intelligent actresses. It was rumored that Lauren was adding another woman to the cast, and she was irate. In fairness, she was also exhausted. It was 5 a.m. after writing all night. She felt there wouldn't be enough for the girls and that this girl was too similar to her. There wouldn't be enough screen time to go around. I revived my old argument. How could this be true if we make up the show? A bunch of us suggested that they collaborate instead of compete. And of course, that's what they did with great success once they were actually in a room together. But where does that initial panic come from? This is what I tell young women who ask me for career advice. People are going to try to trick you, to make you feel that you are in competition with one another. Oh, you're up for a promotion. They go with a woman, it'll be between you and Barbara. Don't be fooled. You're not in competition with other women. You're in competition with everyone. Also, I encourage them to always wear a bra. Even if you don't think you need it, just, you know what? You're never going to regret it. My dream for the future is that sketch comedy shows become a gender-blind meritocracy of whoever is really the funniest. You might see 4 women and 2 men. You might see 5 men and a YouTube video of a kitten sneezing. Once we know we're really open to all the options, we can proceed with whatever's the funniest, which will probably involve farts. My honeymoon, or a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again either. If you get this reference to David Foster Wallace's 1997 collection of essays, consider yourself a member of the cultural elite. P.S. Why do you hate your country and flag so much? My husband doesn't like to fly. He does fly now because he doesn't want our daughter to grow up thinking he is a Don Knotts character. But when we were first married, he didn't fly. I made him fly once before we were married because he was offered a free trip to Vienna, Austria, to direct a sketch comedy show for an English-language theater. If you know anything about Vienna, you know that they love Chicago-style sketch comedy. The Viennese do not enjoy American sketch comedy. Anyway, not knowing the depth of his fear, I bullied him into taking the free trip to Austria, assuring him that I would be with him all the way and talk him through the flight. To get to Vienna from Chicago, you fly to Zurich, drop through the bumpy air pockets around the Alps, land, then take off again. This is the worst thing for fearful flyers because they all cling to the same fact nugget like Rain Man. Most planes crash during takeoff and landing. Most planes crash during takeoff and landing. We were doing twice as much taking off and landing as he had agreed to. This was unacceptable. He was miserable the entire week we were there, distracted by worry about the trip home. I swore I would never make him fly again. Just years later, we get married. Marriage leads to a honeymoon, which traditionally involves travel. For our honeymoon, we book a cruise to Bermuda because it leaves from New York. We don't have to fly to Miami to get on it. We board the ship from a giant hangar on the west side of Manhattan. There are guys playing steel drums and handing you drinks. They don't ask if you are a recovering alcoholic or if you are on any medications that might interact negatively with alcohol. This is maritime law. You get a drink without asking. After a brief muster drill where no one pays attention to where their lifeboat station is, the fun begins. And the first few days are pretty fun. We have a little room with a balcony. The couple next door has a balcony about 10 inches away. They don't introduce themselves, but they are comically drunk most of the time, and the wife wears a spangly American flag bikini, leading me to believe that she is a retired stripper. There's a pool, kind of. It's more like a big sloshing kiddie pool, and if you get in it, you feel like you're taking a bath with strangers. There are some wonderful Filipinos who fold your towels in the shape of a different animal every night. It might be an elephant wearing your sunglasses or a duck wearing your sunglasses. It's just fun. Don't overthink it. There are fun activities hosted by our cruise director who calls himself Dan Dan the Party Man. He has recently replaced the previous cruise director, Pete Pete the Party Meat, who replaced Guy Guy the Fun Times person who had recently died of autoerotic asphyxiation. No, that part's not true. That's a joke lie. I'm not going to lie to you in this story because I want you to know that the rest of this is true. Dan Dan the Party Man leads poolside games that include people pretending to be horses in a steeplechase, a dance contest, something with beach balls. At mealtimes, we sit at an assigned table. The other two couples at our table are middle-aged in-laws from the Delaware Water Gap, Richard and Barbara, Betty and Bernie. We talk about dog breeds and fishing. My knowledge of both topics is equal. We agree that the ship's food is as good as any restaurant in New York between 48th and 50th Street on 7th Avenue. Betty and Bernie say that they wanted to take this trip as a do-over of their honeymoon. Apparently, they had honeymooned in Bermuda 35 years ago, and the whole trip had been a disaster because Betty broke her arm falling off a scooter. Never rent a scooter in Bermuda, Bernie says. Betty overlaps him. They always tell you on these cruises, don't rent a scooter when you get to Bermuda. You're not used to it. You'll have an accident, but people don't listen. Oh, we all agree. People just don't listen. While our little six-top gets along fine, we are all silently jealous of nearby Table 20, a mix of young couples and stray gays who are hitting it off big time. Every lull in our discussion of German shepherds we have known is filled with a boisterous, drunken laugh from Table 20. It is worth noting that at this time, I had been doing Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live for two full seasons. I am not recognized by anyone. Well, I am recognized by the guy who refills the soft-serve ice cream machine by the pool, but not for being on TV, just for lingering. For, oh, the desserts! Rows and rows of pastries laid out cafeteria style. Some of them are unidentifiable squares of pink stuff. I think we called it junket back in the 70s. They don't taste good. But like a schoolboy at his first co-ed dance, I am drawn not so much by their beauty as by their unlimited quantities. On day three, I am very excited to attend one of our special excursions for which you pay extra. We're going to get off the boat early in the morning in Bermuda, where we will be given bicycles. We will ride our bicycles around the island with a guide to a special secluded beach where we can swim and have rum swizzles. And then we will be taken back to the ship by a party boat. Sounds pretty good, right? That's what I thought, too. I wouldn't shut up about it. For weeks before we left, I bragged about how I had chosen the best excursion. It was fun and fitness combined. It was a great way to see the island. My husband and I wait at the designated pickup point at 8:30 a.m. No one else shows up. A quick check of our itinerary reveals the heartbreaking truth. The bike trip was yesterday. In my excitement, I memorized it wrong. I cry. I cry like a 3-year-old who just wants to take her toy cash register in the bathtub. I cry in a way that reveals that I'm not finding the rest of the cruise that fun. This is definitely the low point of the trip, until the fire. Oh, yes, there's a ship fire coming in this story. Wait for it. Once my fitness and fun dreams are dashed, I start to lean hard into the food. Soft serve, hot dog time at the pool, a nightly aperitif called the chocolate mudslide, which is basically a 20-ounce chocolate shake with a thimble of Baileys in it. The last night of the cruise is formal night. My husband, who for legal reasons I will call Barry, is wearing a suit that he had custom made for him by a Portuguese tailor in Pennsylvania. I am wearing a dress that was foisted on me by some aggressive Russian salespeople on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Needless to say, we're feeling very continental. Photographers come to the tables and take formal photos of us all, as well as novelty photos of us being menaced tableside by a woman dressed as a pirate. During dinner, there is a passenger talent show, and sure enough, the little gay from Table 20 does a tap dance, cheered on by his new best friends. Those assholes. After dinner, we settle into the ship's 1,000-seat theater to enjoy the 11 p.m. performance of Fiesta Caliente. The house is packed for this musical dance celebration of Latin pop music. One of the dancers is warming up on stage as part of the pre-show, a theatrical convention that my husband and I can appreciate because we're from New York and we know about things. My chocolate mudslide is going down smooth when we hear three bells. Bing, bing, bing. But instead of Dan Dan the party man, it's a woman's voice and she's breathing heavily. She sounds Filipina, if that's even a thing.
Bravo, bravo, bravo.
She pants.
Main engine, starboard side. Bravo, bravo, bravo.
We hear the speaker shut off. People look around a little nervously. The dancer warming up on stage makes a beeline for backstage. Within 3 seconds, the bells are back. Bing, bing, bing. Oh, thank God. It's our Greek captain.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. Please proceed to your master stations.
This is not what I wanted him to say. We get up and make our way painfully slowly through the completely full theater. Everyone is quiet, which is the worst. It is scary when a group of people all know instinctively not to joke around. Another voice comes over the PA repeating,
"Please remain calm. Please proceed to your muster stations."
The German half of me is thinking, "Shove the old people out of the way. Shove the old and the infirm. If they are strong enough to resist you, they deserve to live." The Greek half of me wants to scream at our Greek captain. I do neither, and proceed obediently. We stop at our cabin along the way so that I can change into sneakers. I have a strong urge to lie down and pretend this is not happening, like the old couple in Titanic. That's how I want to go. Ice-cold water rising around our spooning bodies, and me somehow successfully willing myself to nap. I tie my Sauconys. This is a paid endorsement for the Saucony Corporation. "We should hurry," Jeff says quietly. Damn it, I promised myself I wouldn't use his real name. We head to our muster station, grateful that we went to the drill. Women and children are put to the front, men in the back. They really still do that. I hold Jeff's hand diagonally through the crowd. We're going to be one of those stories of a couple that died on their honeymoon. We'll be on the local news. They'll identify Jeff by the monogram inside that suit jacket. I think about how horrible it will be if I have to get on that lifeboat and leave him behind. Another announcement.
"This is Dan, your cruise director. We have a fire in the engine room due to a burst fuel pipe. Our crew is working hard to put the fire out, and I will update you as I have more information."
Uh-oh. Where's Dan Dan the party man? I look around. There are several tween-age girls in tears, girls who have no doubt watched Titanic more times than you have looked at your own stools. There are littler kids laughing, unaware. There are the dopes who broke their arms and ankles on scooters. People really don't listen. Who are now wondering if it will cost them their lives. The wildly drunk man from the cabin next door to ours is in front of me in the crowd. He's so drunk that he's standing in the women and children section. He complains loudly that this is boring and we're a bunch of assholes. When a clearly terrified woman blurts out, "Please, sir, be quiet." He sways for a second and then lets out a long, "Shit up."